At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey, what up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball. We continue my conversation with Pat Burke. Of course, Pat was a star in FIBA basketball. Most notably, I would say in Spain is where he's most known for playing and being a menace. Of course, played in the NBA with the Orlando Magic and with the Phoenix Suns. How did he get to where he got to? And this is coming off of, by his own accounts, a disappointing senior year. Here's part two, the beginnings of the pro journey with Pat Burke. Pat, you get done playing at Auburn. Okay. Well, take me through the process of, because back then there was, right, there was Phoenix, which was for seniors. And then, of course, there was Chicago. But there was also, what's the one in Virginia? I can't remember what it's called.
Portsmouth.
Yeah. What did you attend?
So I went to both Phoenix and Chicago.
Okay, so you go to Phoenix, and as we had discussed in a previous pod, disappointing senior year. You were way too bulky to start the year. You couldn't move. Okay. But and you've been very honest about your confidence going up and down and up and down. Your confidence was really high coming into the year. And then what do you remember about going to Phoenix in terms of your own personal expectations?
I remember, when I got there, obviously you're seeing some of the best athletes from that year. So I just went in and just thought to myself, I just have to have a good showing. There's a combine, so you're doing all types of tests, vertical and sprint, defensive slides, all of these things. But then again, it still played out, as I recall, that, coaches were also looking to make their mark. So a lot of playing time, even though it was spoken like, hey, guys, this is not about me. The coach would share, this is not about me. This is about letting you guys get your exposure. And that's not what happened. It was, the guys who were, more of a, let's say, a star at the time, those guys would have played more minutes. And I wasn't complaining because I was, again, I was very satisfied being there. I had a lot of gratitude for even being there, understanding that, a couple years ago, I never even thought this was possible.
Okay, draft night. This is 1997.
Yeah, right?
1997. Who's your agent?
Warren Legarry. I actually, Warren came out as a front runner. I went through a couple of different interviews, and his partner at the time, he kept telling me, "Oh, I work for this really great guy. And I'm like, "Well, then why can't I have him as my representation?" So he said, "That's no problem." So then we went and I started speaking to Warren. I met him after the first game in Phoenix at the combine. And he came up to me and he was like, "Wow, you're a really good athlete." And, he started complimenting me. And he said, "I'm getting some good feedback." And so then like that one of those evenings, I went to dinner with him and I was out with like all these NBA coaches and GMs and just, fish out of water. And, so anyways, after the combine, we went through Milwaukee, Houston, I think Chicago, as some of the teams that, you know, had some interest. So when I'm done with going through and kind of doing like a one day workout, Milwaukee shares to Warren that he's like, hey, if Pats are there at 46 at the second round, we're going to pick him up. So I get all excited. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is incredible. You know, I never would have thought this was coming true. So I call my mom and dad and I'm like, hey, you're not going to believe this. You know, they said this is my dad's like, well, you know, it'd be great if you came home and we could celebrate this together. And I'm like, dad, well, there's a chance that this might not happen. This is just, you know, because again, as with sports and professional sports, as you know, it's like, you know, things can happen behind the scenes. So I said, don't make a big fuss. But that's not what happened when I got home.
So what happened?
So I get home and there's a huge tent in the backyard. True to any Irishman, my dad throws a four kegger. And so all my high school teammates are there. Marty Waters is there. Neighbors are there, all my dad's pals. And I get home and I'm like, holy shit. And I'm like, this is not happening. And you know, I'm the youngest of six. So my siblings are going around like, don't worry, this is going to be great. It's going to be great. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like, this might not happen. And if we're sitting there watching the television, and my name's not called, it's going to be pretty freaking embarrassing to have all these people there. So everyone's coming up to me and you know, I'm hearing from their version of what my dad says. They're like, oh, this is so exciting. You know, you're Milwaukee, well, it's going to be a great fit for you. And I'm like, no. And I'm going through one by one, like, this might not happen. They're like, oh, sure, it's going to happen. So television goes on. They're starting to go through the first round. You know, that time, Tim Duncan, you know, I think is the first pick. And they're going through all these guys and everyone's like, this is so exciting. Gets to the second round, 42nd pick. Gentleman comes up to the podium, you know, for the 42nd pick of the 1997 draft, the Milwaukee Bucks select Gerald Honeycutt from Tulane. And I'm telling you, I'm sitting there and all my friends, everyone's behind me. And when I turn, there's just styrofoam cups like floating in the air. And there's just this vapor of everyone's leaving the room as fast as they can.
That one had to hurt, right? Yeah. Gerald Honeycutt, known as Meat to Meat, ends up going 30. It was actually 38. It's the 38. But let me ask you, there's a bunch of traditional centers that went, okay? I'm going to ask you honestly, which one of these hurt the most? Okay? Because I got, hold on, Adonel Foyle, okay, who had that great career at Colgate, right? He was ninth. Scott Pollard, Kelvin Cato, Paul Grant, John Thomas from Minnesota, Serge Zwicker from North Carolina, Jason Lawson from Nova, Paul Rogers, Mark Blunt, and then some foreign players went as well.
I think when I was out in Phoenix and the Chicago thing, I think I compared myself to who do I look like? And Paul Grant stood out to me. And I was like, you know what? I think I can compare myself with him. So when Paul went, I was like, okay, that was kind of, no one in the room would have known, but I was like, you know, I think this is probably the most likely of people that's next to me that I know this could probably happen. So when it didn't, man, I kicked the door and I walked out my front door, started walking down the street, kicking rocks, just like, this is bullshit. I've just wasted all this time and never had any clue about you know, a couple specifics, what was going on behind the scenes. And of course, I didn't realize that I had a, you know, a Bosman status, and we'll get into that later, and yeah, having been born in Ireland. So I just thought it was over. And so then my brother came out to the front door looking for me, and he's like, Pat, the New York Knicks are on the phone. And so right away I was like, I lit up and I'm like, okay. And I'm sorry, that was one of the other teams I worked out for. So I ran back to the house and got on the phone, and I was delighted to hear that they were like, look, we were trying to figure out how to work some deals behind the scenes in the second round, couldn't get anyone to bite, but we'd love to invite you into our summer league roster.
So what would Warren say about about what your expectations should be about what to do next?
I think he kind of went over again, like, you know, hey, it was a funny draft. There was a lot of early bigs picked up. But this doesn't mean the end of it. And, you know, like any agent, anybody who's been in the business for a while, he's trying to put a positive side. He's like, this is great. Now nobody owns your rights. So now you can go play for anybody you want in the summer. And I think that we could still make a roster. So, he said, you know, the Knicks, I've been talking to them. They really liked the workout that you had. And, they'd love to bring you on. And I think that you go out and make a statement in the summer league.
So when did you go to New York?
So I go up to New York, maybe, I don't even know how soon after that. I go up to New York. Jeff Van Gundy is the coach at the time. So I get up to their training space. I think it's in Rochester. And so I'm training with about 20 guys, and they're trying to get to the final cut. John Thomas was one of their picks. He was there. And so just working as hard as I can. I just remember this gym that we're working out. It was at a small college. It must have been 115 degrees in this gym. And Jeff Van Gundy, just sharp tongue. Just if you were not in line with what he wanted, he was going to call you out. And he was just blunt. I just remember guys, like, they would sit there and go get drinks of water, and he would just be, you know, explicit, like F-bomb, like, what the F are you doing? You know, no one said get water. And he's like telling guys, you know, he's like, look, if you're not putting your best effort into this, he goes, good luck to you in the future. He goes, if you think other teams are going to come at you now, he goes, go get your high school gym, go in there, get a trainer, call NBA teams. And when you get in the gym, just lock the effing door, because nobody's coming. And guys were just getting called out. Like, I mean, there was one guy who had something on his, he had a tattoo on his arm. It said like, pain or something like that. And Jeff was just like going up, the coach just going up, he's like, pain. He goes, that should say dumbass. And I was just sitting there like, I had never seen anything like it. You know, coming from Tommy Joe Eagles and Cliff Ballas, and of course my high school coach, I've never seen the business side being so real that, you know, if you weren't what they were ordering, they're just kicking you out.
Summer League, was it Long Beach State or was it?
Yeah, it was Long Beach State. So I get out there and it was great. Like, you know, I remember John Thomas was getting into a lot of foul trouble. So I was next up. And I just remember I had something to prove. And so every time I got the ball under the basket, I was just dunking on everybody that I could find. And just everybody was like, holy shit, like, you know, Sir Dunk-a-Lot. You know, and I'm like, look, I'm just keyed in on everything that I can do to become one of the best players inside of this showcase. And at the end of it, Van Gundy came up to me and he started sharing with me two things that were very, very interesting. One, he said, hey, Pat, I know your agent, Warren. And he goes, but I'm going to tell you this. We really like you. And we're going to do something the New York Knicks have never done in the history. We're going to offer you a guaranteed contract to an undrafted rookie. And I was like, holy shit, this is it. I just made the NBA. And he goes, but your agent's also telling me that you have some pretty lucrative deals that are coming from Europe. And I still didn't understand the whole Bosman thing. So when I get home, I have a guy who's been out for a while, Rob Redan. He's my roommate, big 7-footer. And so I was sitting there and I said, Rob, what would you do? And he goes, man, I'm telling you this, I've heard a lot of people go to Europe. I said, but if I had that contract with the Knicks, I would sign that right now. And I was like, okay. So then I talked to Warren, and Warren was like, look, you can sign that contract and I probably, it's going to be great. You're going to be on an NBA team. You'll have an NBA lifestyle. He said, but I'm telling you, you know, the Patrick Ewing is not coming out of that game. And everybody is convinced that you haven't reached your potential yet. And what I mean by that is, if you go there, you're not getting in, you're not getting game experience. It could be one and done. And what I have for you is there's an Italian coach coaching a Spanish team in the Spanish league, Sergio Scariolo. And he says he likes you a lot. And I guarantee you that you'll probably play anywhere from 25 minutes and up in every game. And I think that you're going to get what you need is more development. So I sat there and I'm looking at these two options. And, you know, then of course the money came into it and I was like, okay, here's, the NBA minimum, and I'm looking at almost twice the amount to go play in Spain. And I was like, okay, this is really cool. And then I started thinking about what Warren was sharing. So I said, Warren, I'm going to go with the Spanish opportunity.
All right. So you pack up your stuff and you go to Spain. What do you remember about arriving in Spain?
So obviously having a European background, I get over there. You know, I don't know any Spanish. I get there during the middle of a festival. It's a small town called Vitoria. It's just outside of Bilbao, northern Spain. Very good basketball club. And there's a festival going on that everything is shut down for like 2 days. So the handler that picks me up, he's telling me in broken English, like, okay, there's this festival going on. Here's your apartment. I get into my apartment. I don't have any. Now, we're not even on the euro currency yet, so it's pesetas. So I'm sitting there. I have no pesetas. The banks aren't open. So for like almost 2 days, I'm sitting there in my apartment. Like I'm like, okay, I haven't eaten. I'm walking around. I can't exchange anything. Everything's closed down. I remember I get to the first practice and I go up to Sergio and he's like, hey, you know, how are you doing? Checking in. I said, Sergio, you know, I'm starving. I haven't eaten in like a day and a half. And I just remember he was like, you know, apologetic about it. But that was my first experience. And then of course, when the practices started, it was not just a culture shock, but the basketball and, of course, the way it was coached was totally different than what I was used to as well.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
You had what Elmer Bennett was kind of an old head, and yeah. What Brent Scott as well. So yeah. for people who don't know, and I think this is right when, I don't know if Bozeman's status started then. I thought it started in 2000, but you had a European passport, so you didn't count as an American.
Yeah, so it's actually started 1 year before I got there. There was a gentleman with the last name, surname Bozeman, and I think he was a German national, and he was playing in Spain or France or Italy. And so for people that don't know, when you're playing overseas, there is there's an agreement in each league of how many foreigners can actually penetrate a roster, because they don't want to have, of course, what's happening in the NBA. They're looking to protect the national side of things. So they want to make sure that they're cultivating the younger guys who are coming in, of course, protecting the contracts of the Spanish guys. And then they have like two spots. So it's changed a lot since I played. But at the time, it was two Americans or two foreigners, and everybody else could be just a European national, which Bozeman would go underneath that. So understanding the very easy way to think about it is just they were getting an American with me joining the roster, but I was only counting as one of the European guys.
Right. Okay. So what was your season like? And as people have come to learn, the style of basketball is very different. You point out the coaching is very different. It's still, it kind of almost collegial in that it's coaching centric more than player centric. Right. Yes. What was that adjustment like coming from Auburn to now playing at Taos Ceramica?
So I'd say the buildup is, you know, when I was at Auburn, you know, you're watching the NBA, you know, you're watching every game, and there's that fast paced, you know, alley-oop dunks, you know, four quarters, last second shots, all of that. And so that's kind of something that kind of gets seeded into your mentality. Like, I can't wait for this to happen. So when I get to Europe, I'm sitting there and everything's slowed down, and it's very tactful in its, it's focus. So everything becomes five guys from working for one good shot. You know, it's all about, you know, like getting ready for every team, like with just hours and hours of practice sessions, going over pick and rolls, how we're going to actually play, you know, on the ball defense. So it just becomes, it becomes very cumbersome. It becomes to the point where I just feel like I'm taking shots in the beginning that they're like, no, you're not going to do that. So it was almost like I was this wild horse and they were trying to put a saddle on my back. And at first I was bucking it off. I was like, no, I'm not going down with this bullshit. I'm going to keep playing the way I want. And so Sergio and I, we got into a lot of arguments.
But you guys won the league, right?
Well, we went to the finals that year. So just making it to the finals. So again, is it for any of the people listening, the European has a kind of a relegation system where, you know, depending on how your team does in one season, that'll generate kind of where you're going the following season. So what happened was, is we actually qualified for the highest European tournament at that time. And it was something that they hadn't done in the history or a long time in the history of that team. So they were very excited. There was a lot of momentum. We played very well. We had a great unit as far as the collective and all the guys. And so what I was starting to realize is what I was trying to fight, I really started to appreciate more and more as the season was going on. I started to realize, you know, there is a sense of family here. There is, you know, the collective of all of us. You know, when we would go to meals, pregame meals, we were all, you know, joining in with family stories and how we were doing. And there was something that I didn't have in other teams. So having gone that far all the way to the finals, it was something that, looking back, I took with me every year after that. Is we made it all the way to the finals and we didn't win, and that hurt. And I remember Sergio Scariolo at the end of the season was like, you know, in Europe we have what's called pseudo campeons. It's like the second place, and we didn't want to hear we were second place because, you know, we had worked so hard and we believed that we should have won that league. But at that time, TDK Manresa, they had our number. And so it just turned out that from that point forward, I was like, I understand how much you've got to put into this. And if I ever get a chance to get all the way back here, I'm not going to, you know, take this as a as something that you just, you know, you get there and you just kind of rest on what you've been working for. I'm like, you know, I'm going to put as much as I can into winning every time we get into this.
Okay. So you get done with that year. What was the decision like as to what to do next?
So I actually had a, you know, there's shorter contracts in Europe. So usually they'll have like, there's a 1+1 and it'll be like, you know, you can agree on it or the team will agree on it. And so at the end of that, I just didn't connect with the coaching. And I knew that a lot of the other guys like Brent Scott, who really became like a brother to me, they weren't looking to bring him back, and they were looking to bring back Elmer Bennett and some other guys. And so at that time, I went home for the off season and I told Warren, I said, I don't think I want to go back there. And so then this team Panathinaikos in Greece contacted him, and they had watched me play and they had scouted tapes, and they were like, look, you know, we'd like to sign Pat to a 2-year deal. And so I was like, okay, well, at that time, so I'm back in the summer, I start working out for Cleveland, the Cavs, the Chicago Bulls. And then when I finish working out with them, both of those teams offer me a minimum deal. And I'm back to that same situation like with the Knicks. And so I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, I can take this now, or I can take even bigger opportunities with bigger financial, contracts than what would have been offered for these minimum deals. So then I went and I signed a 2-year deal with Panathinaikos.
Now, the only thing about signing in Greece is people think you're only going to get half your money, right? Like the old story in Greece is guys are making half what they tell you and they only get half of that actually into their bank account. What's the reality? Now, you played on the biggest club in Greece. What was that like?
I'm fortunate enough that in my contracts with Warren, I'd see the gentleman side of Warren. I said, but there was a bulldog behind the business side of him. And I never lost $1 with any of the teams I play with. So I get to Panathinaikos. And two brothers own the team, and they also own a very large pharmaceutical company. So the budget for the whole team was so large that they would delay monthly payments, you know, because there was so much they were like, you know, trying to make as much as they can on interest or wherever they had invested their money. So there was times where I'd sit there and I'd be like, look, you know, this is very awkward, but, you know, there's money that, you know, we've signed a contract for. And so then it would go like another 2 months. And I remember I've gone up to our coach, Coach Obradovich, and I just started creating a kind of this illusion that I had businesses and people that were counting on me back home. I said, you know, I've got a business back home and there are people that I'm paying and I got to make sure that keeps going. So I might have to fly back during the season to take care of this, to figure out what assets we're going to, like, you know, change over so I can pay these people.
And remarkably, you got paid.
And remarkably, yeah. So then these two little guys come into the locker room, and all the Greek nationals, they're all terrified of them. So these two little guys are going around. They're just going, "You have a claim? Do you have a claim? Do you have a claim?" And I was like, "No, I don't have a claim. You know, I just know that I have an agreement. You know, we made an agreement." And they're just looking at me like, "Why is this one guy not afraid of us?" And I'm like, "You know, the reality is, you know, there's basketball everywhere. So if you want to break the contract, we know we can go somewhere else." So then after one game, we win a game and I'm coming out the tunnel, and these two guys, they're way up at the top. They practically have two thrones sitting there watching the games. And as I'm walking through the tunnel, just underneath them, they stop and they're like, "Burke, Burke." And I look up at them and they're like, "We sent the money." And I was like, "Okay, thank you." You know, and just walked into the locker room, like, you know, awkward, but I guess it's just the way it's done.
How'd you play?
So that first year I got in there, I was the understudy to Dino Raja. And that first coach that I had there, he was Dino's best friend. And it was the most awkward situation, because you're coming from college. Now you have one experience in Spain where everybody's treated the same. But Dino was the exception. Dino would, since he was the best friend, he didn't come to the training camp the same as us. His girlfriend shows up at the training camp and stays with him. Before games, the experience was extremely militant. So they wanted us, like, all together at a hotel, taking a nap, eating our meal before even home games. So after the meal, when we'd all have to go to sleep and go to our rooms, Dino would eat his meal and he would just walk out into the parking lot and just start to walk away. And so one day I was like, "Well, you know, my wife is sitting at home. I think I can go take a rest at my house." So I start walking out and the assistant coach comes out to me, and I'm just standing next to Dino and we're both kind of walking to our cars. And he's like, Pat, where are you going?" And I said, and I'm just looking over at Dino. I said, "I think I'm just going to take a rest at home before the game." And he's like, no, it's better that you come over here and stay in the hotel." And I keep looking over at Dino, and Dino gives me this half smirk, like, "Hey, the rules don't apply to me. They apply to you." And so I was like, you know, in the best interest of not starting an argument, I just walked back in and just followed suit. And again, it goes back into, you know, like, I think most people who've played in Europe, they realize, like, when you get there, you're slowly being hypnotized into a culture. And then before long, it's like you're just giving up your thoughts. You're just like, "Okay, this is what we do. This is how we do it." And every year, Doug, every year I had left in those 9 years, as soon as I got on the flight to leave, I would sit there like shaking my head like, "Oh my God," they had a total hypnosis over me about what to think, what to wear, you know, what I was supposed to do. And then you'd finally be freed of it because you're allowed to think for yourself. And that's one of the things that I recognized, that, you know, European mentality with the coaching and the whole idea of team is extremely militant.
It really is. The next year you got the start, right? Dino, what, did he retire?
So Dino then went over to our rival team, to Olympiacos. He got another bigger contract. So he ends up leaving. Big news inside the newspapers. We sign a new coach. We didn't go as far as we wanted in the European tournament, but we did win the Greek league that year. So the next year they bring in Zeljko Obradovic. And around that time, if you remember, you know, kind of in the world of basketball, so it's around 2000 now, this is when Yugoslavian coaches are really the pinnacle of thoughts of how to produce the best basketball teams. So a lot of what they were producing as far as, like, you know, going on, like, we used to go to these training space in
big guards. They like big guards.
Big guard. Well, the point guard role was broken down. It was like a science, and I almost felt bad for every point guard we had because that's where our coach was. He was a point guard in the past. So everything they would do was just righteously told, no, you stop right here. And it's two dribbles, not four. You know, you go over here and you make the fake this way with your head, the ball over your head like this, and you do this, and this is the speed you do. So everything was broken down to this exact ideal model. So when Obradovic came in, he changed the whole system and he started challenging every one of our players. So then he also brought in at the time Zeljko Rebrica. And so Zeljko had just won the Italian league. And so when he came in, he was the starting center. So he was, you know, at that time we had Dejan Bodiroga and Zeljko Rebrica came in. And those guys were, you know, like at the time we were playing for the national team. And this is what I was sharing about the USA team. This is around the time that there was a huge disruption in any type of international basketball, you know, where, you know, from like 2000, 2001, these guys were, you know, they were winning gold medals. They were taking out our USA team. And that's right around the time that USA tapped out and said, look, we got to rethink this, how we're building teams. And they got Mike Krzyzewski involved.
It's interesting. So my first pro experience, I was with Inter Performances, right? So they were the other big agency overseas. And in 2000, we had a Yugoslavian coach, and the plan was because I could get Israeli citizenship, I'd be a Bozeman B. Right, you're a Bozeman A, yeah. I was Bozeman B. But what I remember is I go to training camp, and we have the other point guard is Heath Mr. Jennings, who's like 5'8", 5'9", but unbelievable scorer. Played in the NBA, East Tennessee State, like unbelievable score. And he's kind of an old head, right? I think probably 30 at the time. And so I'm the backup point guard, but, and because I'm I would have been an Israeli, like, okay, it fits. But the only thing you could do to overcome, because we had a Yugoslavian coach, the only thing you could do to overcome the fact that you were small is you had to play in the NBA and be able to just go get buckets, right? Otherwise, if you weren't 6'5 or above, you couldn't be a playmaker. Couldn't be a point guard, right? So this guy, I'm telling you, like in training camp, like he hated me. And what's crazy is like I played mostly the way that they'd want to play, but I was just small, yeah. You know, just small. And but it was amazing on how they truly believed like that there are specific passes, a number of dribbles, a way to enter the offense, a way to cut, like. I mean, as you point out, like specific, this is the only way to do it. And like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was very, very confusing to me. But at that time, okay, so now you've been in Greece for a couple years, right? You started to, I think, was it when you went back to Spain that you established yourself as probably, you know, the premier or one of the two or three premier centers in Europe? What year do you think was the peak?
Well, I think so. I finished Panathinaikos and I went to a smaller team, Marousi. And that's when I got my opportunity to showcase what I could do. And so had a good year. And so coming out of that, you know, a lot of people come up to me. I remember we actually even played Panathinaikos in our home gym and we beat them. And I hear from one of my good friends, Johnny Rogers, that the two owners are yelling at the coaching staff, like, why did we ever get rid of him? You know, and so after that, I get a phone call from my agent after that year that I played so well. And he's like, hey, that first team wants to pick you up, you know, the team in Spain, Tau Ceramica. So I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, they've been looking to get you back for years. And I said, okay. So then they give me an offer. It's the largest offer that I've ever, ever had. And I'm like, holy shit. So I said, well, I've heard a little bit about this coach. So let me do some research with Elmer Bennett. So I call Elmer and Elmer's like, Pat, you and this guy will not mix. And I'm like, okay. All right. So I call back my agent. And I'm like, I don't think it's going to work. He's like, okay, you sure? And I'm like, yeah, he's a lot of money. I said, no, I understand. Now at that time, my wife and I, we just had newborn twins. They were premature. They had heart monitors on them. And so now I'm not just looking out for myself, my wife. Now I'm looking out for an environment that's going to help me to be, you know, a better father and not have a bunch of stuff getting in my head. So anyways, he calls me back like 10 minutes later. He said they upped the offer. So now it's even more. So now I'm thinking, okay, money's going to solve everything. So I go over, sign the deal, go in. I said, one thing I got to get. Now, this is at the point where I've played 5 years and money is really, you know, even though this is a great deal, money is not the ultimate, because I realized I've just missed my brothers and sisters. I've missed weddings. I've missed, you know, I missed funerals. And I was like, you know what? My family time is going at the wayside here for all of this stuff, because, you know, when I get over there, it's so militant, you're not allowed to leave anywhere.
It's not just that. It's like, for people who don't understand, like, you end up missing it's a family, like sports on TV, regular, you know, on one hand, right? Very profitable life. And in terms of basketball, and I'm guessing, what, two practices a day everywhere you went, correct?
Yep.
Two practices a day. So it is a job. It is a lot of work, but oftentimes, like, it's basketball. It's not, but all the things you're missing, like, there's a value, there's a tangible value to that. And you can't, something goes wrong or somebody needs help, you can't hop on a flight and fly from Spain or Greece to just be home for a couple of days. Like, once you're in, you're in. Once you're out, you're out.
That's exactly it. And so I asked to go to my brother's wedding. So my brother was getting married in Ireland during the preseason. And I said, you know, I'd like to get, you know, 5 days off to get up there, go be around my family. So the owner of the president of the team, Kerry Hete, he says, okay, so we signed the deal. Long story short, didn't work out with the coach. He was like, no, you got an option. You can either go to your brother's wedding and be off this team, or you can stay with us. So I shook his hand. I said, well, good luck to you this year. And everybody in the town hated. They were like, oh, we don't have a center now. Like, this is unbelievable. Like,
so, and then you went to Real, right?
So no. So then I get a call from my brother's wedding. I'm sitting there. I'm leaving at 1 a.m. This is the coach. He took my 5 days and they agreed. They said, okay, you know, we'll let you go for 2 days. So I go to my brother's wedding and I'm flying back to Spain. And someone in the lobby comes out and says, hey, there's somebody from the Orlando Magic on the phone. And so I get on the phone and this gentleman tells me, one of their scouts, he's like, look, Stephen Hunter just tore his ACL. I think that you could make the team. And he's like, how's Spain going? And I'm like, it's not going well. You know, I'm ready to give everything back. So anyways, I go and I come back. I leave Tau Ceramica and I make the Orlando Magic. And I remember it was like, everyone's like, you know, where'd this guy come from? I'm like, hey, you know, I've been in America for a long time, you know? And they're like, you know, Grant Hill, Tracy McGrady, like, where'd this dude come from? And I'm like, I've just been playing overseas for 5 years. So then just getting my name back into the mix, you know, I go in and I'm a starting center for like the first 9 or 10 games. And, you know, I think that kind of charged that, okay, you know, this guy, he is an NBA caliber player. And then all of a sudden it became to the point where when I went back, because after that year, another just a little tangent is, you know, Doc asked me at the end of the year, you know, would you like to come back? And I said, Doc, I'm taking a huge pay cut coming back here. The season didn't go the way I would have liked. I think that my best playing style is to play with European teams. And he understood. So I said, thank you for the opportunity. And that's when I went back. And of course, like a year later, I'm playing for Real Madrid. And I think that's where the Phoenix Suns then started to realize, like, look, this guy can play.
Okay. So for people who don't know, we mentioned the two practices a day. Okay. Paint the picture of the differences. Let's start with Marusse, where you had that great year. What was their facilities like? They have a practice gym. They have a regular arena. What was it all like?
Very small. It's probably could fit 1,000 people. Smaller than a high school gym. There's two staircases going. One would go into the locker room, an unfinished locker room. It was just a big concrete slab cell with like a spigot hose, and everyone's sharing a shower. And then on the other side of the basement, there was a weight room that would, you know, had like two dumbbells and, you know, just a couple kettlebells. So that was that year, but it was a great family experience, even though you knew that it didn't have, you know, the most high tech and best equipment. You know, there was a lot of people around. There was a very good owner who cared a lot about, you know, the team and the guys and putting together the best team that he could in environment. So coming from there and then coming over, then walking into, you know, the Orlando Magic practice facility where I'm getting a retina scan to get in the door. They're doing some like sci-fi thing with my hand. They can fingerprint it like two or three times. So then there's like a laser beam that goes by my hand to let me into the practice facility, you know, with a gate. And then you get in there and there's just a bunch of Range Rovers and Lamborghinis sitting in the parking lot. It's a totally different experience.
And by the way, I'm looking at Marucci's gym. Pretty well, it says it seats 1,700 people. It does have stands on the side there. Yeah. And this is interesting because you played later in Russia in Himki, yep. When I played Tiny Gym. And then we played, I don't know if Mineral Voda was in the league when you played, but they literally had stands behind the basket, a little bit behind the benches. And then they had like a track that people were like four or five deep on, and then a wall on the other side. I was like, how do they make any money on this deal? Like, how does this even work? Yeah. It's like such bullshit. It was amazing.
Yeah, I don't think it's the same business model as far as the owner's investment.
It's all a mafia thing where they do something. Yeah. But
no way. I mean, they're not even making that much money. Like, if you think about the NBA with just the merchandise, you know, the ecosystem that they have with merchandise, tickets, fan experience, everything. I think that most of Europe is just on television rights alone, you know, and I think that that's what they have. And it's funny because you see such a difference in the fans and of course the business owners that, you know, when you're in the NBA, you see all this sensationalism. Everything is just so heightened about the experience and everything that's going on. But when you get to Europe, it's just very cut and dry. This is what we're here for. You know, we're not here for all these little frills and this and that. You're not here to like sign jerseys and sign or sell any jerseys or hats or anything like that. So it's a very different world.
Okay. So you're with the Orlando Magic. You played my guy, Pat Garrity, right? Ironically, you're the Irish one. He's Irish, but from Colorado. Right? Yeah. But if somebody would have said, hey, who's the Irish national playing for the Magic? They would have put Patrick Garrity. They wouldn't have picked Patrick Garrity.
Sure. And since then, they still do it. Like someone will see me and they don't recognize me. And I'll tell them, yeah, my name is Pat. I played for the Magic. They're like, oh, you're the Irish guy. I'm like, yeah. Like, man, you used to knock down those threes with that hitch with your foot. I'm like, that's Pat Garrity. And I don't even know if he's... Yeah. there is a lot of that. It's like, and you know, I don't look to fight it. It's just like, you know, if they even realize that, you know, there's another guy named Pat on the Magic, I'm like, that's cool.
What was Grant Hill like?
He was amazing. I remember when I got there, he was probably the first person just in the preseason, just playing 5-on-5 pickup. He was the first person that was like, man, you know, like you can really play. And when someone at that caliber tells you something, you know, you go home and you tell your parents, you tell your wife, you know, I'm sitting there like it's boosting my confidence. And so that was a really cool thing. And then just before he got hurt, just playing with them, you know, his court vision and his ability, like, I don't think he was attempting to get everyone involved, but him being on the court, like I was getting a lot of points just for him seeing me cut and drive and running, you know, running the floor. So when he got hurt, it was like everything just completely changed. Like just the whole system of the way the ball moved started to change. And then, you know, of course, then it became really more Mike Miller and Tracy McGrady that would get the ball all the time. But when Grant was there, I remember I was reading a book, like I think it was like a Motley Crue book or something. And it was one of these documentaries that had a lot of just incredible stories. And I remember just on the bus, I just finished it. And he was like, hey, you know, can I read that? And I'm like, sure. And I'm thinking, what would Grant Hill want to be reading something about like a heavy metal band? But, you know, he's just open to, you know, a lot of conversation. And I've seen him since. He's still the same person. It's like you can sit there and you can just have a chat about anything and everything. And, he, you know, there's no ego inside of him. He's just, you know, he's sitting there and he's a very caring individual.
That was the last year Sean Kemp was in the league.
Yeah.
Give me your best Sean Kemp story.
If I do this podcast might go I don't know, might go over to someplace you don't want it to. That was my road guy. So Sean, right away, Sean and Daryl Armstrong and myself, we got along great. And so like whenever we weren't playing or we were on the road, you know, we were the three guys that would go out and get a beer. And I just remember there was a road trip where, let's just say it was a 5-game stretch. And so the first time we pull into wherever it was, let's just say it's Denver. We go out, we have a few too many. We're sitting there the next day after the game, we're showering up. Sean's probably had 12 points. He's got like 9 rebounds. Daryl's got like 18 points, like 12 assists. And I'm sitting there with 1 point and, you know, probably I fouled out. And then the next game, same thing happens again. Then by the third game, and we're going out, you know, all the time, they're sitting there like, let's go, Road Dogs. This is working. This is what, and I was like, guys, we're sitting in the shower. And I'm like, guys, I don't know if this is working out for me. You know, I know we're going out and having fun, but I'm just not playing the well. And they're like, don't ruin this, Burke. Don't ruin this. This is good. And I'm like, I don't think this is good, guys. And they're like, we're going out tonight. And I'm like, okay, whatever. And I just remember like Doc Rivers coming up to me later. And he's like, Pat, Sean and Daryl, they get after it pretty hard. I know you got a good head on your shoulders. Like you need to look out for them. We're going to need them. And I'm like, okay. And I'm like, who's looking out for me? You know, but yeah, just great, great guys, great memories. You know, just, it's just funny at that point. Cause you know, like with any athlete, you're looking for some sort of consistency to say, how are we living our lives that we're able to go out here and still perform. And their variables were going out with me, having a few beers. And then, at the end they were sitting there comparing stats, but as long as theirs were good and mine were shit, everything was fine.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bissell Pluma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Why Tracy McGrady at that time should have been like at his peak, right? The next year, next 2 years, he led the league in scoring.
Yeah.
But he didn't win. Okay. He didn't win. Why?
I'd say just experience, you know, again, is, you know, coming from Toronto. You know, I don't think you can ever, how would I say this in an approach? It's like saying to somebody, hey, I want you to think of a color you've never thought of before. You know, it's impossible. So how could he think differently if he's never been all the way to the top to realize it? Like, you know, in a comparison, like when I was playing with Spain and we went all the way to the finals, that was the most success that I've ever experienced. So everything that was coming in was a new minute. It was a new 10 minutes. It was a new hour. So I was like, wow, I've never been in this situation. When I look back at Tracy, you know, here's all this talent, you know, great guy, but you know, leadership, they say, is lonely. So I think that a lot of times he was leading just by his physical example, but was it doing enough, you know, outside the court? You know, was he putting enough demand on us and what we were doing? Because I remember I went through a whole confidence thing again where I just sank. And I remember he just kept coming up to me like as if it was, you know, some sort of valuable counseling. He's like, Pat, you're fucking good enough. Let's go. And I'd just be like, okay, you know, and that would be it. So I think going into that year, you know, we're in the playoffs, you know, we're up against Detroit. And then, you know, he communicates something into the newspaper about how easily we're rolling through Detroit, woke them up. So again, as there's another moment where I'm sure he said, I'll never do that again. You know, and I think that, a lot of what the Magic organization, and I'm not trying to bash them, but a lot of what the Magic organization is, it looks like guesswork at times, is how do we come back and start winning? How do we get to that caliber? And they're building it around Tracy, and they've got the injury with Grant. So I think, you know, a guy like me at the starting center, it's like, everyone's like, who the hell is that guy? So I think that even the roster at the time was not going to be one that was going to support him to go far, you know, in that year.
What was Ben Wallace like to guard?
He was a beast. You know, I think there's a lot of, guys that fit the bill as far as, you know, the size, their stats, all that. But here's this unorthodox 6'8" guy playing center with just Hulk strength and just his hard hat, you know, going out. And so, I just remember that, you know, he was good friends with Daryl Armstrong. So I would get a lot of communication of like what he was thinking during the playoffs and what he was saying. And I just remember thinking that, you know, this guy is, you know, somebody that I would love to find out what he's doing and how he's figuring out how to get these extra rebounds. You know, what are the techniques that he's using? But just a beast at that time.
Doc, obviously, he catches a lot of shit because how many of his teams have been up 3-1? Yeah. This was like this was the first one, right? You have 3-1. You mentioned with Tracy, yeah. Like you lived it. How much of the fault or blame does Doc deserve?
I could say that I don't know every conversation he was having behind the scenes with players. I think that, of course, you know, you're managing ego when you're an NBA coach. You're also putting together, you know, the best rotations that you can. You're looking at, of course, everything that you're doing and is it working? So at that time it was working, but I do know this. When we went into that last game, Doc's a great motivator, but I don't know where the hell he got his last motivational speech from, because it was something about how Coca-Cola is the number one selling soda. And it puts millions of dollars into its marketing. And then he started comparing Pepsi. And Pepsi does this, and Coke does this. And I'll tell you what, by the end of the damn motivational speech, I think we're all thirsty for a soda. You know, it was like, I walked over at Daryl Armstrong, and I was like, what the hell did that all mean? And Daryl was like, just be ready tonight. And I was like, okay. And, you know, we go off and we lose the game. But for that to be his first one, I did hear that, and rightfully so, I'll own this, you know, again, is he said, if you look back on those rosters, especially the first one, you know, I don't even know if we should have been in the playoffs. So he put a lot of work into the regular season. I remember his door was always open. You know, he communicated to me all the time. You know, we had just lost Horace Grant in the beginning of the season with, you know, a confrontation that happened on one of our plane rides. And when Horace was left from the team, the next day, Doc was talking to me about, I'm going to start you. I believe in you. I think you can do this. And again, as it was like, okay, I've never had a coach like this at this level that's talking to me about belief and allowing me to do what, you know, whatever I could do on the floor. But again, as I think that he's learned a lot from it.
No, it's interesting you point out, right? That roster, if you had Horace Grant and you have Grant Hill, well, now that's a much different roster than the one that ended up the season where you have, you know, Gordon Gierichek, Drew Gooden, who's super young at the time, Pat Garrity, Daryl Armstrong, and Tracy McGrady. That's the starting lineup, you know? It's the starting lineup in that last game. What happened with Horace, and what was the confrontation of?
Oh man. So we're coming in from, I think we're out west and we're getting on the plane, and Horace is one of the last to get on. So I would sit to the right side of the plane, and Sean Kemp was in front of me. I can't remember. Oh, Horace would have been behind me. And then just to my left, there's a long couch. And of course, we all know that's Tracy's couch. Like, he's going to sleep, he's going to get rest. And so just in front of him, there's the other rookie, Ryan from Notre Dame. So we're sitting there, and Horace, yeah, Ryan Humphreys, I had a loss there for his name. So then Horace gets on and he's talking to Sean a little bit, and this and the other. And next thing you know, Tracy says something to him, to Horace, about something he's been saying. And he's like, you know, I heard you, you know, you've been sharing something about, you know, leadership of the team and this and the other. And Horace looks over at Tracy and he gets so emotional, he starts stuttering. And next thing you know, he's just like, no, that's not me. And again, I won't get into all the dang cussing he did, but he was saying, you know, Doc was behind some of this. So then he turns his back towards the back of the plane. He's looking in the front and he's talking to Tracy, and Daryl Armstrong gets up and Sean's talking about, they're like, cool it, calm down, this and the other. The next thing you know, Doc Rivers is right behind Horace as he's on this just rant about, you know, cursing out Doc. And I'm sitting there, I got front row seats, man. I'm sitting there, Conor McGregor, like, I'm just like, holy shit. And I look over and Ryan Humphrey's got his head buried in a magazine. I'm like, nah, dude, you want to watch all of this, you know? So I'm watching this. And I mean, Doc is a big man. So he's like, hey, he says, Horace, you got something to say to me? And Horace turns around and he's looking right down in his face. And he's like, yeah. And they start going at it. Right. And then Sean and myself and Tracy, we're all getting up. We're splitting them apart. Nothing, no swings were thrown. Split them up. And then we're all like, holy shit, did that just happen? You know, that just happened. And then we get off the plane, you know, and everyone's just getting out. And then the next day, you know, they tell me that Horace has been released from the team. And that's
and this is you coming back from Europe where it's a dictatorship, right?
Yeah. So I'm just like, this is insane.
Yes.
Yeah. It was a totally new experience because you realize that, you know, we're all grown ass men. And, you know, when, I mean, again, just like in any family, I still believe like with any culture, any community, any group, any tribe, you have to go through adversity, and adversity on the other side of it will start to build or forge something else. And so that's where the adversity was starting in the very beginning of that season. And there was some communication patterns that I was noticing as a trend, like going, okay, something is happening here because someone's not taking the reins or someone's complaining about their position and they're starting to point fingers.
All right, that's it for part two of my talk with Pat Burke. Part three will get you to the Phoenix Suns experience and what life is like for him after basketball. What's it like to shut it down, to know that you're done, and then to kind of put your American life sort of back together and figure out what you want to do next. A collection of thoughts and stories, and I think you'll be interested to hear what it was like to play in Phoenix when he had to play in the playoffs after a gigantic suspension of Boris Diaw and Amari Stoudemire. Remember that when they were playing the San Antonio Spurs in the NBA playoffs? Yeah, that was Pat Burke. What went so wrong for him in that game? You'll find out on part three. In the meantime, a reminder, the Doug Gottlieb Show is daily, 3 to 5 Eastern time, noon to 2 Pacific. We also have the daily podcast, which is uncensored, unfiltered. You'll love it. It's called In the Bonus. That's on the iHeartRadio app. Just download it wherever you download podcasts, In the Bonus or the Doug Gottlieb Show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.
At Bet365, we don't do ordinary. We believe that every sport should be epic. Every home run, every hit, every inning, every play. From the moments that are legendary to the ones that fly under the radar. Whether it's a walk-off grand slam or a base hit to center field. Whatever the sport, whatever the moment. It's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be present in Ohio. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Pistol Puma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.